You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row. In this podcast, we're bringing you some of the highlights of this year's annual public law event, held this year at King's College London. The topic was unlawful detention in immigration cases. Alistair Henderson began his observations by referring to a recent BBC documentary on the government's immigration removal centres.
Last week, on the 4th of September, Panorama broadcast an undercover exposé of the conditions at Brooke House Detention Centre, Immigration Removal Centre, just next to Gatwick Airport. It contains some pretty horrible scenes of real breakdown in order and discipline and any kind of compassionate care and humane treatment of some of the detainees in that centre. It follows a young man called Callum Tully, who left school, was trying to find a job, and decided to sign up with the illustrious company G4S, who have the contract to run Brooke House IRC. And he was so horrified by what he discovered in there that he decided to become an undercover reporter for the BBC and spent several months wearing a hidden camera and recording some of the events he saw. And it's a really fascinating documentary because it shows, on the one hand, some very stretched workers in that detention centre trying to do their best, a large number not really coping and passing the buck on a lot of decisions, and some fairly horrendous examples of people who really didn't care at all. And it highlights a real problem we've got in detention centres in this country, which is that we detain a fairly large number of people for immigration reasons every year. And it is a controversial issue and has been for some time. And there are particular challenges at the moment because of three things in particular that are highlighted in that documentary and flag up as an introduction to this section. The first is that the UK is the only country in the EU which has no maximum time limit placed on immigration detention. Most countries in the EU follow the Return Directive, and the Return Directive has a maximum 6-month immigration detention time, or 12 months if certain criteria are met. And actually, many countries take a much more lenient approach even than that. So, to give you just a few examples, Ireland has a maximum 21 days of immigration detention, France 45 days, Belgium 2 months, and Portugal and Spain 60 days. The UK is a real outlier. We don't have a stopgap last final time. I'll come back to that point in a minute and kind of throw it open slightly as a question to ponder whether we should have one. The second issue that is really exposed in that Panorama documentary is the increasing issue with drug abuse, and in particular that being a symptom of the increasing prevalence of immigration detainees who have not committed any offence other than an immigration offence. They've entered the country illegally without leave, or they are a failed asylum seeker or whatever, with convicted foreign national offenders who are being deported. And as you might imagine, when you put a failed asylum seeker in with an armed robber who served his time and is now being deported, sparks can fly. It's actually something that there's been a shift on recently. The government has come under pressure not to keep foreign national offenders in prison at the end of their sentence. In fact, the courts have made it clear that it's not unlawful necessarily to keep a foreign national offender in prison at the end of their sentence before you deport it. There's a big case, Idira, which held it wasn't necessarily a breach of either common law or Article 5 to keep someone in prison pending deportation. But the courts have become much more alive to it, and it's scrutinised quite hard now. As a result, more and more foreign national offenders are being put into immigration removal centres before being removed. It's not a big problem. And then the third problem is the administrative barriers to deportation. In particular, the constant delays in getting emergency travel documents, problems in getting identification, and all sorts of other hurdles that come up that prevent people who otherwise should be on a plane heading home from actually heading home and staying in detention for far, far too long. A rather horrifying statistic that comes up in the documentary is that in a six-month period in 2014 to 2015, the Home Office only managed to use 2 out of every 5 plane tickets it bought to remove people, which is a pretty terrible use of resources and a pretty terrible psychological burden on the people in detention who think they're heading back and then are ending up in detention for even longer. I said I wanted to come back as a kind of introductory question to the issue of should we have a time limit in immigration as a result of this expose and the general trend of more and more cases about unlawful immigration detention. The point being, essentially, just to remind you, the current legal framework, although it has some fairly tight constraints on immigration detention, never sets a time limit. So there's 3 main restraints. You've got the common law, Hardy Olsen principles, 4 principles are set out there. And in particular, factors that the court take into account include the vulnerability of detainees. So mental health is something the courts are very alive to now. And there have been several cases involving mental health being a key factor for immigration detention being found unlawful. The second key restraint is public law principles. The major case of Lumba back in 2011, which is still the go-to case for the basic, setting out all the principles of unlawful detention, also held that public law breaches mean there's an unlawfulness of detention in addition to a breach of the Hardy Olsen principles. And then the third area is, of course, human rights. Article 5 is obviously relevant. In many cases, doesn't make a difference to the common law, but every now and again, it does. And Articles 3 and 8 are increasingly pleaded and raised in a detention case because we might have someone with a serious mental health issue, with drug abuse problems, with physical health issues, and breaches of Article 3 have been found. When you've got detention actually making mental health problems worse, you might get over the threshold for Article 3. But the point really is that all 3 of these main forms of restraint don't apply a final stopgap, a final time limit. Because, of course, it sounds obvious that maybe a time limit would be a good thing. There's at least 3 or 4 obvious advantages of it. The first is that psychologically it'd be much better for detainees to know that they can only be in detention for a certain amount of time, that there is an end, a light at the end of the tunnel. Secondly, it might put pressure on the Home Office to deal with cases more expediently. They can't leave things lying for month after month. And fourthly, it encourages better use and more resources being put into alternatives to detention. But there is potentially a problem. And the problem is that in countries that do have a time limit, you often end up with defaulting to that time limit being how lots of people spend detention. There's less rigorous scrutiny at an early stage because the state goes, well, we can keep someone for up to 3 months, 6 months, so we'll only look at it as we're getting towards the end of the time.
Alistair Henderson of One Crown Office Row. Suzanne Lambert took the discussion further by analysing recent unlawful immigration and detention claims.
If you have seen the Panorama Exposé or even listened to what Alistair said about it, it wouldn't be surprising to know that there are a number of unlawful claims brought before the courts in the UK, and it's fair to say that quite a number of them result in damages awards. Between 2012 and 2015, for example, just under £13 million was awarded in unlawful detention claims. And a Shore review of the welfare of detention of vulnerable persons, which was published last year, resulted in a promise of a number of reforms, most notably a decrease in the numbers who are detained and a decrease in the duration of the detention periods for those who are vulnerable. But Home Office statistics published last month indicate that no such decline has been realised. The Shore Review also recommended that those with serious mental illnesses should not be detained on the basis that their conditions can be adequately managed in detention, which is something which is referred to very often in the case law. That recommendation hasn't been taken on board. So it's safe to say that unlawful detention claims will continue to come before the courts in large numbers. And so it's quite interesting to look at a few of the recent cases that have come before the courts and have been decided, to look at the relevant factors, in particular in relation to the 2 questions. First, whether the detention is unlawful, and then secondly, whether substantial damages should be awarded in a case. But it's quite useful and interesting to look at a few individual cases. The first one, SMM, is a European Court of Human Rights case, and it's important because it underlines the importance of the duty on the Secretary of State to act with due diligence in order to progress a case. As Alistair pointed out, there is no limit on the length of time that someone can be detained in immigration detention in the UK. And the European Court of Human Rights made it quite clear that that duty to progress a case with due diligence is heightened where the detainee is considered to be vulnerable, as he was in this case. And more importantly, that duty exists even where the applicant's solicitors fail to take action, as they did in this case. The facts are set out on page 62, and I'll summarise them very briefly. The applicant was a Zimbabwean national. He had serious mental health issues, didn't want to return voluntarily to Zimbabwe. At the time of his detention, there was a stay on forced removals to Zimbabwe, yet he was detained for 3 years whilst that stay was in place. During his detention, a second asylum application was made. His solicitors asked for more time to submit medical evidence. Somewhat unusually in this case, the Secretary of State had to keep chasing his representatives for that additional medical evidence, and we know that it's usually the other way around. The applicant brought a judicial review challenge, arguing that his detention was unlawful because there was a failure to apply the regulations which require the release of persons detained under immigration rules who had been victims of torture or who had been suffering from a serious mental illness. Second round of challenge was that it was unlawful to detain him when there was a stay on enforced removals to Zimbabwe. And then finally, that his detention was arbitrary and disproportionate because of its excessive length. Permission was refused all the way to the Court of Appeal on the grounds that there was no independent evidence of torture, and secondly, that his mental health could be managed in detention. When it got before the European Court of Human Rights, the findings in relation to torture and mental health weren't disturbed, but what the court found was that the applicant had been held or detained for an unreasonable length of time, given all the circumstances of the case. And the court found that the Secretary of State should have taken more decisive steps to bring the decision-making process swiftly to a close, particularly given his acknowledged vulnerability. It was accepted that he had serious mental health problems and therefore he was vulnerable. Secondly, there was a heightened need for the government to process and ultimately decide a claim diligently, given how long he had been in detention for almost 3 years. And there was an additional necessity to ensure the effectiveness of the available procedural safeguards and to act with appropriate due diligence given the absence of fixed time limits on detention in the UK. As you would know, indefinite detention has not been successfully challenged in the European Court of Human Rights. For example, in the case of DRAG and UK, it was held that the availability of judicial review challenge meant that there was no violation of the convention. The court did draw attention to the need for safeguards where the government has chosen to put in place a system with no fixed time limits. The second case is the latest in the saga of the detained fast-track litigation, which you might be familiar with. This case followed the successful challenge to the DfT, which allowed for fast-tracking of processing of asylum claims. And it also followed the compromise of test case litigation involving the claimant, in this case, YA, and three other lead claimants in a case known as JM. It was accepted that the safeguards of the screening and Rule 35 processes did not provide an effective safeguard to prevent an acceptable risk for vulnerable or potentially vulnerable individuals whose claims required further investigation. So the DfT was not appropriate for those sorts of individuals. In this case, the admin court held that the continued detention of the claimant here, YA, under the DfT had been unlawful. The Secretary of State should have conducted his screening and medical examination and should have made a decision as well as processed his release within 8 days of detaining him. Instead, what happened in his case was that the request for a Rule 35 report and was not heeded, and in spite of his solicitors referring him to the Helen Bamber Foundation, which actually did accept that his circumstances met their referral criteria and were appropriate for further investigation, he was not screened, he did not have a proper medical examination, and he remained in detention until he was granted interim relief by the courts, pending the outcome of JM. Had the correct procedures been followed in his case, then the screening and medical examination and the operation of Rules 34 and 35 would have identified him fairly quickly as a possible victim of torture who was not appropriate for processing under the DFT. His case was simply too complex for the detained fast-track scheme. The test identified by the court was whether it would have been open to a reasonable decision maker directing himself correctly in relation to the policy to detain the individual in the circumstances of the case. Clearly, that had not been done in his case, as evidenced by the detention reviews, which failed to refer to the risk of absconding or, of course, did not have the benefit of a Rule 35 report. This is, of course, the first case which has come before the courts after the stay, which was in place following the outcome in JM. As the Deputy High Court judge noted, it's not known how many of these cases have actually been settled, how many cases remain to come before the courts. So it may be that we will see quite a number of these post-JM cases being reported. A third case, Mwasa, involved the removal from association of a Kenyan national who was due to be removed. She'd been disruptive in the past when attempts had been made to remove her. So as a precaution, it was decided to remove her from association for 24 hours prior to her removal. As it turned out, she was removed from association for 4 hours more than she had been properly authorised. And there'd been some pencil scribblings on the form, on the reverse, which indicated that a proper officer hadn't authorised the additional period of removal from association. It was held that the requirement of authorisation was more than just a procedural requirement, and the failure to obtain that authorisation was not just a technical error. Rather, that authorisation is a fundamental safeguard of Rule 40. So we see that the courts are being quite strict in terms of how detention is governed and ensuring that safeguards are in place. Speaking of orders being brought in at the last minute, one of the grounds of challenge was that she did not have the opportunity to make representations and complaints, and there was no policy or guidance in relation to that and a number of aspects. By the time it came before the court, there was a new detention services order produced, which addressed exactly that. So sometimes it does take litigation to focus the minds of policymakers to ensure that various issues are catered for in policy guidance. I will do the last one, Wamala, but what's interesting is that it involved a failed asylum seeker from Uganda who was supposed to be removed. He'd been given a removal notice for 2 p.m. Christmas Eve. He applied for judicial review and he believed that removal would be stayed pending that judicial review determination. When the time came for removal and he wasn't removed, he wrongly assumed that he wasn't going to be removed. But it so turned out that his removal had been moved later that day to 8:30 p.m., but he hadn't been told. Obviously, that would be unlawful. They came to collect him at about 3 p.m. There was a struggle on the airplane. He suffered both physical and psychological injuries because he genuinely believed that they were trying to kill him. So Justice Walker held that the private firm that had been tasked with carrying out the removal had used unauthorized pain compliance techniques, which were agonizing and caused difficulties breathing and had used violence in dragging him off the plane. He was awarded substantial damages, including £8,000 aggravated damages and £10,000 exemplary damages. And in awarding exemplary damages, Mr. Justice Walker took the view that the defendant had showed complete indifference to the legality of removal and its approach to Home Office policy and requirements of his own service agreement was shocking and outrageous. So just a further note to that, which is that the Independent Monitoring Board has, in a recent report in July, noted that this particular firm is generally too willing to use excessive force and use restraint techniques without appropriate safeguards. It also has noted that the chief immigration officer often delegated this job to escorts who lacked the requisite training. So again, perhaps fertile ground, unfortunately, for future claims.
Suzanne Lambert of One Crown Office Row. LawPod UK is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.